In lesson one, which is the first handout we've been in forever, page 16, I just want to do a very quick look at this. There's a number of things I'm kind of brushing over here at the end of this, but it's printed out fully enough. You can read it and ask me questions in another setting if you want to. For those who might listen online, this is page 16 in the first handout. The second handout will be online after this audio is put up, and that will begin us in the areas of literary analysis of what we call genre. You know, I don't know about you, I learned the word genre in a class on children's literature. And I'd been in seminary for a while. I'd been through college and was in grad school, and the word genre just was never used. And I could explain that, but I'll give you a chart and show you why, but I'm not going to do that right now. But I learned it in children's literature. It was a fascinating course I loved. But it's a very important idea of the kind of literature that the Bible is. And you'll notice on page 16, it's just a preview of where we're going, and we're starting with what's known as narrative. Narrative is typically referred to as stories, but they're special, and we'll see some of the reasons for that. Narrative is such a huge piece of the Bible, and we'll mention that in the beginning of our lecture this evening. But primarily prose, style, telling a story of human life with literary conventions to convey divine perspective or just perspective on the lives of these people. Another piece of genre, a major genre in the Bible, is we call it legal. I say major, it's really rather sparse. Everybody thinks Moses' law was huge, but remember they referred to the Pentateuch as the law. The actual codes are really rather few, and I'll give you a chart next time showing you how two or three chapters are set in a narrative, and they are the codes. It's even thinner than our Constitution, and yet it was able give them a model from which they could proceed. But the legal codes, I'll tell you later, but just to mention it, legal codes were not a means to get to God. They were a means to please God. If you got a bull that horns people, take care of it. You got a dog that bites people, take care of it. But the codes are really very thin. Poetry is a big piece of the Bible, next to narrative, maybe the second largest. I don't have a percentage on that. But poetry is interesting, and I'll show you some pieces where we can set a poetic account right next to a prose account, and you can see how they differ. The poetry, of course, is very bombastic. It uses lots of figures of speech and hyperbole, whereas the prose account is ho-hum, and we'll see some of that. But poetry is an important piece. There's a lot of things that get answered about meaning. Like, for example, everybody says, well, what is wisdom, the wisdom of God? What is it? Well, if you read poetry correctly, you'd have an answer to that. And we'll see that when we get to that point. Wisdom and Proverbs. There is really not a lot of wisdom literature. There are a few books that are dedicated to it. Proverbs has wisdom. Job is particularly that way. Ecclesiastes, some of the Psalms. In our culture, we think of wisdom as the product of knowledge. My daddy used to say, that man doesn't have much education, but he's really wise. Well, my dad meant is he says what I want to hear, is basically what he meant. And we think of wisdom as the result of knowledge. In the Bible, that's not the case. There's certainly an aspect of wisdom in another way, but formal wisdom is a knowledge of its own. A knowledge of its own. We'll talk about that briefly later. The prophets, here's my view of it, covenant policemen. They were calling Israel back to a broken law. They weren't keeping the law. They weren't following things that a believing Israelite should follow. And like policemen, they came along and corrected that. A lot of the prophets is poetry, so the poetic aspects will come to play there. I'll give you, we'll have a fun lesson on figures of speech before we do poetry, because poetry is dominantly figurative language. And so it's a good idea to get that under your belt. The gospel, that's a unique form. In the time of Jesus, there were a number of forms floating around, but the what we have in the Bible is very unique. If you compare extra biblical gospels, there's even a Gospel of Thomas, which is one of the cleanest, and there's a Gospel of Peter. There's a number of these, and yet when you read them and then you read the gospels that we're used to reading, you can see that there's a significant difference in the quality and the nature of that writing. It's a unique form, and we'll be seeing that. An epistle is a letter. People joke and say an epistle is the wife of an apostle. I don't know where they came up with that. It doesn't really make any sense, but that's cute. An epistle is a letter. If you write a letter, typically your letter is going to be what?
Short.
Short, often.
To someone specific.
Context specific, yes. Letters are written we call them occasional literature. They're written for an occasion. When we get to this New Testament material, we'll see how that works. And then apocalyptic, which is in the Bible in a number of places and ends the Bible with the book of Revelation. It's a part of what we call the prophetic genre. And it's the, you could use a number of words to describe the apocalyptic features. And we'll see that when we get there. But anyway, there's a preview. These are the literary genres we're going to march through. And we will not be marching as slowly as we have in some of these introductory things. But nonetheless, there they are. I do hope you'll go back and read, particularly the material in front of page 16 on Calvin and the witness of the Spirit. I'd love to go over that. Too much time. I do have some of that in the book. Somebody asked me if I had any more copies. I'm really getting low because it's gone electronic, and I don't have any more print copies. But I've got a few. If anybody didn't get one and wants one, I also have another fire sale. This is another book I have. In fact, this book has a lot of articles that are quite interesting, like backgrounds to the Good Shepherd discourse, like. You know, Psalm 23, you know, shepherd in the ancient world was a king. That's the way shepherd was used in a lot of literature. It wasn't used for the guy in the field, but was used as a metaphor of a king. There's only one article in this book that is scary looking because it's got some Hebrew in it. These are all very readable. In fact, maybe more readable than some of the stuff in Fee and Stewart. Fee and Stewart can get a little dense, but they have space restrictions. The chapter we're in this week is very much that way. These are only $5. The other one's $10. If anybody's interested, I'd be glad to get that weight out of my house. All righty. Now, let's start thinking about narrative. Literary genre is a kind of literature. It's a certain way of writing. A writer can tell a story, compose a poem, give a proverb. Write a letter. There's all kinds of major aspects of literary genre in the Bible. Each kind of writing makes a point in its own way. And it's not a mystery, but that's the learning curve that we all have to go through to deal with the way literature makes a point. Over 40% of the Old Testament is narrative. It's because of such big chunks of poetry, it's actually a low percentage, but the Old Testament's quite long. And 60% of the New Testament is narrative. Where would the narrative be in the New Testament primarily? The book of Acts and the Gospels. Even though the Gospels are a literary kind of their own, they still fall in the camp we call narrative, and we'll see that later. So a narrative is going to be a story that's well-crafted, and it makes its point by using what we call literary signals, devices. These stories are intended to be history of God's people with all their struggles, good and bad. Fee writes the New Testament part. Stewart is the one who's writing the Old Testament parts. But he talks in the early part of that chapter, and I'm going to refer to the book a little more this evening than I have been, because there's so much important stuff in here. I think it'll help us. He has what he calls a hierarchy of narrative, and he talks about stories, redemption, and this meta-narrative. He kind of reverses it from the way I would do it, and I'm just going to put it up here the way he does this with meta-narrative, redemption, and then the stories, and you read through this, and the stories make sense in light of redemption and the meta-narrative. In fact, the Bible is about the history of redemption. So, and I would probably, I like the pyramid this way. Meta-narrative is the foundation of the thing. Redemption becomes the biggest piece of the Bible, because after the fall in Eden, everything is about God's redeeming the people for himself. And then the stories are the pieces that log that redemption for us. Very selective, to be sure, even though the Bible is a pretty good-sized book. John said the world couldn't contain what could be written just about what Jesus had to say. So if you consider all the things that were going on within the Old Testament period, you'd have a big bunch. Let's think about meta-narrative first. Meta-narrative means what? And in a simple way. The biggest story. Yeah, the biggest story. Creation, fall, redemption, restoration. This is a very, very common model. And it follows just happens to follow the sequence of the way the Bible unpacks for us. Restoration, of course, shows up in all kinds of places. But redemption and restoration become the big themes. Creation and fall really take up a very small piece. Only three chapters. Then you got the rest of the Bible about redemption and restoration, and then, of course, there is this issue of the final restoration. And it's interesting to me, if you think about Genesis to Revelation, you have those, you got creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. But if you think about Genesis to Malachi, and then re-engage with the Gospels through Revelation, you have exactly the same story. And yet, it's so everywhere you touch the Bible, it sort of bleeds this meta-narrative. And like I said before, if you have problems sharing faith with people, just tell them that story of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. Just share that with them. You don't have to be an expert at it. Those terms are almost defining in themselves. That since I'm a creature of God, created by God, that makes me responsible to God. And God has set forth Himself in His covenant love to seek out a people and to redeem them. So you can go on and on with that. It's a very straightforward way to be a witness. So a narrative is a story well crafted. Makes his point by using these literary signals. C on page one of that handout. Furthermore, this total story leaks from every part of the Bible. Don't need to elaborate on that. And I think, as I mentioned here about witnessing, when you're challenged by a person who really hates Christianity for a number of reasons, those are probably the best people to talk to because they're already stimulated. And say, you can believe what you want, but here's what I believe: creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. Now, perspectives to maintain while reading biblical narrative. There's a big emphasis on this within the chapter by Fee and Stewart. So the purpose of biblical narrative at the bottom of page one is to recount redemptive history. The standards of the faith and belief system are usually unstated in the flow of that. But they're understood. There's a common pool of knowledge that both the audience and the author have. An author doesn't have to reiterate that all the time, but can depend upon the audience being able to identify with what he's teaching from the standpoint of that worldview and values system. They're already part of the understanding of faith. Narratives presuppose known teaching from God. The narrative and the authors presuppose that. They do not have to rebuild that every time. And we, I think, are often, we sort of feel tempted to help God and rebuild it ourselves. And that's when we start messing up narratives. Because we're imposing what's biblically true and our own ideas on a text before we've gotten what the text was intended to do. And that's it's very tedious. I'm not an Old Testament expert by any stretch of the imagination. It's challenging. I find it challenging because you can get wrapped up in these big stories, and because you do know a biblical worldview, you can, you know, you can make hay out of it till the cows come home. But that could be an abuse of the Bible rather than a use of it. This aspect, however, is frequently abused by, as they mentioned on several occasions, moralizing without contextual reasons. That is, saying what it means to me rather than what it meant to the original context. Because Bible stories have a commonality to life, it's easy to put meaning into the narrative that the original author did not intend. And it's not that it would be bad meaning. It just ain't there. I heard Gordon Fee in a meeting one time. He was just teasing, and he started singing, "Wonderful things in the Bible I see." Have you ever learned that as a kid, maybe in Sunday school? No. "Wonderful things in the Bible I see, some put there by you and some by me." It's an old little Sunday school for children song that I don't even remember the original words now after hearing that one. But I've done it. I've got sermons I had to set aside. They were good sermons. People liked them. But they were a moralization of the text. I hadn't done enough homework to get to what the text was about. That illustration really doesn't illustrate, so I'll let it go. Page 2. Fee and Stewart warn about the abuse of narrative. What narratives are not? And if you notice when you read the book, this book is a pretty positive book by and large. But this chapter ends up being sort of negative. And here the reason is because there's so much abuse. And then Stewart nails it from every perspective almost. And only in 15 pages. Yeah.
Would you say then that the Old Testament is strictly... from a teaching and preaching perspective, strictly historical narrative and theological, but there's nothing you can take out of there to moralize or apply to the modern church?
You got three things going there. For example, you said it was history and theology. Well, it's history, for sure. You've got to prove what the theology is. You can't just assume it and read back from the New Testament, or because you have a biblical worldview, say this theology is in this text here, unless the author has signaled that. And the issue of can you moralize it? Well, what do we mean? You know, different people will use that word differently. If you're saying, can we learn lessons about life to avoid? Don't commit adultery like David did. Don't cover it up like David did. Don't be like Esau. I mean, yes, that's all true. But the difference is that while that's true ethically, it's not necessarily what one given context intends to teach. We start with what the context intends to teach. If we don't do that, we will miss. I think I've watched this over the years where someone... Have you ever been in a church situation where they preach a different text every week and they say the same thing? I've been there. I've been in a lot of churches like that. Because why? Because they're not studying the Bible. They're using the Bible to say what they're comfortable with, usually without doing homework. I remember a student brought me in class one day. He did it as a joke, even though it wasn't funny. And it was a little paperback book, and it had a pistol on it. And the title of the book was Saturday Night Specials, Sermons for Busy Pastors. If we'd been in the country, we'd have taken it out and used our 9mm on it, but we didn't do that. I'll take it. Maybe I should take that over to Bob if I could ever find a copy of it. All right, anyway. So I know what you're saying, and I have that same tension because I've done it. I've got some really wonderful, biblically true sermons that never accounted for what that text was about. And I didn't do any damage because it was biblically true, so to speak. But what did I miss? Because I didn't get what was happening within that text. And in the Old Testament and these stories, the key is seeing the big thing. I've got some handouts I'm going to show you this evening, like the Abraham narrative. If you take the Abraham narrative as a whole, because I've preached on Lot a good bit, and I have some justification actually from the New Testament for some of the things I did, but not for all of it. But you look at the Abraham narrative, and when you do, you're going to see that the pieces, the episodes, have to be understood and explained from what is the big issue of the Abraham narrative. Well, obviously, the big issue is God's telling us how he used Abraham to make this story of redemption hit the road in relation to the development there within the Old Testament. Let me come to that. I can't jump ahead, because every question would make me do that. And I'm open to the questions. I just may not answer them very much. Look at these three things. These three things are almost direct quotes from Stuart. And I did that on purpose because I want you to see that this isn't just Meter's little hobby or whatever. Old Testament narratives are not allegories or stories filled with hidden meanings. You're not reading that story to find the moral truth. You're reading that story to find out what it says. What was it about? And that may not always be all that non-obvious. It just depends on where you are and what's going on. If you're dealing with Abraham's problem with getting an heir and having children with his handmaid and all those kinds of things, how are you going to explain some of that? Well, that's an aspect of ancient Near Eastern history that comes in to help us, but we can't allegorize that out of existence. Consequently, they are not to be spiritualized by our imaginations, even if our content may be shown to be biblical from other places. And we'll be looking at a few of these examples in a little while. Secondly, and you can read this more fully out of feet, individual Old Testament narratives, quote, are not intended to teach moral lessons. And that's what we want to do with it. First of all, it's easier. A lot easier. You know, your imagination is your only limitation. You know, and if you've got a good imagination, you can go to town. The purpose of the various individual narratives is to tell what God did in the history of Israel, not to offer moral examples of right or wrong behavior. Unless the biblical narrative or narrator makes that point. End of quote. But that's the first thing I think most of us do. I've done it. Probably still do it from time to time. Because it's easy with these big stories and seeing the lives of these people and what's going on there to do that sort of thing. Notice furthermore, we may see lessons of life and narratives, but that may not be what the Bible is teaching there. Until we exhaust what the text intent to teach, we should not default to our imaginations. I'm going to talk a little about Ruth in this handout eventually. That's a fascinating story. The book of Ruth itself is just amazing. It's the first book you do usually in Hebrew classes. The third thing, however, even though the Old Testament narratives, and I'm quoting again, do not necessarily teach moral values directly, that is, the purpose of that context. Remember, the Bible teaches us in three ways. Direct, what's the other one?
Implied
and?
Creative constructs.
And when we're talking about the actual intended meaning of a narrative, we're working down here. And then we have to justify implications and creative constructs out of that narrative. But until we do the direct level, we're working more off of our imagination than we are off of our learning. Even though the Old Testament narratives do not necessarily teach moral values directly, they often illustrate what is taught explicitly and categorically elsewhere. Yeah, we see it all the time. Since divine teaching is the larger circle of truth in which these things sit, such general correspondence comparisons must be clarified as illustrative and not the immediate intent of the text. Otherwise, your imagination is your own limitation. And there's a good place right there. I haven't taught preaching a lot. I always wanted to. But when I have done something in the domain of teaching preaching, and others have done the same thing. I forget the little dictum now. There was a cute little dictum people used to use. Something like this. Tell them. Explain. Illustrate. Tell them what it said. Explain what it means. And then illustrate. Now, when you get down to the illustration level, you're at a point in which you could say, and this is what I recommend, this may not have been in Paul's mind, but from a biblical worldview, we can see how easily this would apply in this manner. But that's a distinction that needs to be very carefully done so that those who are catching what you're saying, and usually in a church, that's very that can be very thin. It's amazing what people hear when you speak. I've been at the door on a number of occasions, and they told me that they loved the sermon, best one they'd ever heard. Then they told me what I said, and I hadn't said anything they said. Because when people listen, what do? You internalize. You internalize it for yourself. Yeah, we got all kinds of filters, and we're applying it to ourselves when someone speaks. And so, but I always like to make that distinction, and you can do the same thing in teaching and preaching. But these are the crucial thing. But when we get to the illustration should have continuity with this. And when we know that it doesn't, at that particular point, we should say so. We should say, now what I'm going to tell you here about what's biblically true is not what this text is about, but it sure makes me think about it. And then you can make that application. But the trouble is oftentimes these get left out. There's another little dictum that comes up in this domain. And it's, have you ever heard this one? One interpretation, which isn't even many applications. You ever heard that one? You know what happens with this dictum? Yeah, that's what happens with it. Meaning, what a text means and how it applies has got to have continuity. There needs to be some continuity in there somewhere. And sometimes, you know, you've got that disciplined text level. Those people had a worldview very similar to yours, probably the same in many cases. But getting to the disciplined text level is what that author was doing. And then the next level is the larger biblical worldview level. And stories, oh geez, you know what I mean? A story is a story. You can, it's like someone wrote a book on symphonic theology. What a symphony, you've got violins, fiddles they should be called, violins, and you've got basses and you've got tubas and you've got every kind of instrument imaginable. And they're all doing their thing. And if you, when they do it separately, it doesn't have the meaning as when they do it all together. But it's, they're a symphony. And a symphony requires perspectives and so forth. And so the Bible and life, I think, does this very same thing. So I'm going to tag a phrase that came to my mind for whatever it's worth. And this is true in the whole Bible, but it's particularly true in stories. The discipline that was interesting. You know what the word disciple means? Disciple. Disciple means learner. By the way, the word disciple is never used out of the Gospels and Acts. It's never used in the epistles one time. Never used in the epistles, the word disciple. There's the verb for learning is used about two or three times, okay? But the discipline of restriction. When I have a task for the study of a text or a theme or something, my discipline of restriction is I know nothing until I've done my research. Because I don't, to be frank. I have a lot of assumptions. I have a lot of general knowledge. But that's not the same as being specific with it. Listen, the Bible is as scientific as medicine or law or any other discipline. It's not some fairy tale. It's not some Ouija board. It's not some book that we can do whatever we want to with. It has meaning, and that meaning is conveyed through literature. And literature has rules. And they're on this piece here in the book because there is so much abuse. And it does end up probably being a little more negative in this chapter because of the over-abuse than maybe illustrative. I think we'll get that illustration worked out as we move on in it. I didn't put them into the notes, but you've read them. But the major cautions at the end of this chapter, what a grocery list this is. Some final cautions at the bottom of page 107. So that you may avoid this tendency, that is the tendency to moralize or to make up the stories yourself in the sense of what the moral lessons are from your own brilliance. We list here several of the most common errors of interpretation that individuals commit when reading the biblical narratives. And he gives some illustrations, but rather brief. Allegorizing. Decontextualizing. You work from the Bible. You don't put into the Bible. You work from the big to the small. Decontextualizing. And that's real easy to do when narrative, because narratives can be so huge. Do you remember from the chapter, which is the biggest narrative in the Bible?
The Joseph?
The Joseph story, yeah. Yeah, that brown nose and his dysfunctional father. All right.
His brothers weren't much better.
No, they weren't. Well, none of us are. Selectivity. I call it cherry picking. And we all know that if you want to prove something from the Bible, just read long enough and you'll find the words that will make it say that, and then you can use that with other people. You know, it becomes a, I call it a crowbar, using the Bible like a crowbar. Moralizing. This is the assumption that principles for living can be derived from all passages. That's the mother of all problems. That's not the way the Bible was written, nor what the Bible intends. You've read that, and you can read it again. I hope you'll read this chapter several times, to be quite frank. Personalizing, also known as individualizing. This is, in fact, the self-centered reading of the Bible. That's what it means to me. And once again, that's not how the Bible should be handled. It'll mean plenty to you if you get to the real roots. Misappropriation. In guidance literature, like in the book on the Will of God that I've shared, is Gideon's fleece. We've heard this one 1,000 times. Lord, in Bible colleges, none of you are going to get this, but it's funny anyway. Bible colleges had more rules than anything else. And dating rules were quite strict. But there were actually students with such a subjectivism that they might set a box of chocolates by the water fountain and pray to God that the first girl who takes one of the chocolates and eats it is the one I'm going to date this weekend. Now, that sounds bizarre. But there was a period in American Christianity when the universities and the religion and universities was so liberal, the Bible college movement got going. And it's in the early 1900s it started. And that was kind of the bastion of training workers. And a lot of its rules and regulations were bizarre. I had a student one time who wrote a paper, How Bible Colleges Teach Their Students to Break the Rules. I loved it. It was a good paper because they make rules that are unbiblical and unreasonable. The administration didn't like that kind of stuff. I still remember going to a kid who'd been kicked out of school. It was in this where I was teaching. I went to his room and sat down on the bed beside him, and he was just devastated. He didn't understand why he wasn't pleasing and as a nonconformist. And I told him, I said, look, this isn't the end of the world, and this isn't the only place on earth. You just need to find a place that you're going to be able to thrive in. Well, about 20 years later, his sister became my secretary. I didn't even know it until sometime later, all this came back and we put the pieces together. Well, he'd been a missionary for many years, successful, did well, and he was then ministering in Indianapolis. And a lot of that was justified from using text out of context. The misappropriation of things. False appropriation, false combination, redefinition. I'm going to let you read these. And as they say on page 110, no Bible narrative was written specifically about you. No.
Not even who?
David. Everybody's David in the story.
Yeah. The Joseph narrative is about Joseph and specifically about how God carried out the divine purposes through him. And we learn by seeing this. That was the same thing as the text you mentioned, Jerry. These things were written as our example. If you look at that in the context of 1 Corinthians, the example there has to do with the Lord's Supper and with the fact that they were abusing, just like Israel abused their privilege. There were Christians in Corinth who were abusing their privilege. Look what happened to Israel, and pray that you get on track so it doesn't happen to you. It's not that they're an example in any way you want them to be morally, but they're an example of that specific thing. That spiritual privilege is not in and of itself the gateway to success. Because if you abuse those privileges, you're down the tubes with it. So anyway, like I say, this is a chapter I think you need to read about 3 times. Because it'll take several times through it There are some illustrations, more than I've said, in the chapter, but not enough. We'll see some of them as we go along. So anyway, when you read the chapter, did that catch your attention?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hopefully. B, history is a catalyst for God to convey his view of things. Redemptive history, as we call it. Whether directly, like an event like Sinai, or through an intermediary, as an author of a Bible book spins the story. It's necessary to study the ancient Near East, frankly, to really get the Old Testament. Here's where your Bible dictionaries come in. What about levirate marriage, where the brother-in-law takes his sister-in-law and raises a child and produces a child? Well, in the ancient Near East, your family was your only social security system for land, for the elderly parents and all of that. And you'll say, well, that's bizarre. The Bible doesn't teach it. No, but the Bible sort of winked at it, if you please. In fact, it even regulated it because it was happening in that culture. It regulated it to control it. And it did that in a number of ways. And I think sometimes we find that stuff embarrassing. But we need to remember that God dealt with people where they were, how they were, and brought them to, in time, but sometimes more than one generation, where he wanted them to be. The thing about Abraham is over and over. The marriage laws in the ancient Near East and land tenure and how all of that was ferreted out, the firstborn of the family and their responsibility to the parents, that was all part of the world in which they lived, whether they were believers or not believers. And the Bible comes in and does some regulations with some of the things that existed. And you have to get into a little bit of the ancient Near Eastern history to ferret some of that out. There are some odd things in the Old Testament, to say the least. Some things that were never really corrected. The thing, why did they have multiple wives? That wasn't the norm, by the way. Why did Solomon have 1,000 wives, as it says, whether it's a hyperbole or not? Why?
Politics.
They were treaties. If I have your daughter in my concubine, maybe you won't attack me. In fact, the Bible says a king should not do what? Remember the phrase? A king should not multiply wives to himself. Why did it say that? It didn't say it because, what do we call it? Polygamy was wrong, even though I think it is. The text said that because political alliances with false gods is wrong.
Yep.
That's what that text is about.
Like a lot of the ceremonial laws, I was reading Leviticus this morning, most of them were intended to prevent idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't only a matter of sacrifice, but God was telling them, you've learned this, so I'm trying to keep you away from this, so he limits it.
Mm-hmm. What was one of the biggest challenges to Israel in the Old Testament in terms of idolatry? Remember the name of the god?
Molech.
Well, that was, you don't read much about that, it just stands out. Mm-hmm. Who do you read the most about?
Baal.
Baal or Baal. Yeah,
that's just
showing off when you say it that way. It's Baal to most people. What was at the core of the Baal cult? Does anybody know?
Fertility.
I mean, who wouldn't like to go to the temple and have sex? You know, to be honest, it was not only acceptable, it was expected. Do you think Israel had a hard time getting out of that? How many times do you read in the Old Testament, God couldn't get them separated from Baal? Baal, 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 Baal.
Even in the tabernacle.
It was too appealing. It's kind of like the song about Hollywood. Everything about it is so appealing. Is appealing? Is that what it says? I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't make any difference after all, does it? It's cute. All right. C, the interpretation of history in narrative form is more subtle than direct. And that's why it's more open to us making hay out of it. We have to be alert to clues which convey perspective on the story and what the story is about. The ancient world, and in the New Testament as well, was an oral and an aural. Okay, A-U-R-A-L. Oral, speech, aural, listening. The Bible was intended to be read out loud and heard by most people, not read by most people. And so they would hear these things. It required, and that is an original language thing. It typically is not going to happen in English, because in English, one of the traits of newer translations is don't have the same word in a passage more than once. You have to use a synonym. Use a synonym, you just messed it up, as far as a hearing culture is concerned. We talked about high context, low context. We mentioned fast message. A proverb is a fast message. A legal code or a command would be a fast message. A narrative is a slow message. And it's bigger, more cumbersome to get into. But you read out of the narrative, not into the narrative. Ancient Near Eastern narrative is not like modern history either. You've read the Bible and you're reading it through again quickly. But you probably haven't even noticed one-tenth of the times that the chronology of stories is out of kilter. And I'm going to give you some illustrations in the last part of these notes and in the handouts on some of this. Because in the ancient world, they didn't care about time that much. It wasn't time, and a pun on another word, not time, but kind of action. Now, that's a grammatical phrase, but the fact is that time is a Western thing. I suppose even is Hispanic the biggest term for all the various, you know, from Cuba to Central America? I don't think it's even the biggest term, is it? Which is the biggest word, Latino or Hispanic? Which covers the largest umbrella? Yeah, I know. But anyway, they're interested in how, the kind, how the action took place, not in when it took place. And I will prolifically illustrate this to you, particularly in the New Testament, but we'll see some of that in this handout in relation to the narrative in the Old. D, the meaning of narrative is an understanding how the whole context dictates and directs the meaning of its parts. I'm bumping ahead here, but I want you to look at the Abraham narrative, for example, in that extra handout, the second page of that extra little handout. There is a chart of the Abraham narrative. This person who did this, we team taught. He was the Old Testament guy, and I taught the appendix, as he put it. That's a joke. Anybody get that? All right. This structure is very common, and it's not just the Bible. There's in ancient literature, they use this kind of structure. It's called a chiasm, where you build up and you back down, but you do it in consort. Look at number A, genealogical narrative. Look at A at the bottom with a little doohickey. A prime. Mm-hmm. Genealogical narrative of Nahor. B, call of Abraham. B at the bottom, test of Abraham. Covenant process issues. C, Abraham's deception concerning Sarah. C prime, Abraham's deception concerning Sarah. Good night. See how it's coming back around? D, You can't. I had to write that. I don't know why I didn't. That's not typed there. Lot and Abram part in chapter 13. And then in chapter 19, Lot departs Sodom. E, Abram intervenes for Lot. E prime, Abram intercedes for Lot. F, covenant initiation ceremony. F prime, covenant ratification meal. G, Sarah, Hagar, and Ishmael narrative, which doesn't have an answering narrative, but H is at the center, which is the covenant confirmation. Now look at this. What is the big story? And I don't, that even that kind of terminology is Western world more than Bible world. But the big story is about Abraham as the father of faith, and look what's right at the middle of his narrative. The covenant confirmation. Now, if Rex is going to preach Genesis, he would be finding this kind of thing, and this actually defines your sermon and your sermon pieces. You're welcome. And then you just do your homework because you got your structure. And you got a better chance if you got the structure of and a responsibility to define how B or D or F contributes to the narrative of Abraham and this whole issue of covenant confirmation. We've got tests involved. We got genealogies involved. We got Abram and Lot issue involved. Ceremonies are involved. But at the end of the day, it's that covenant confirmation with Abram, the father of faith. And it's beautiful. And this is not somebody's bright idea. This is pretty common stuff in scholarship and in commentaries that the publisher allows to put things out like it needs to be put out. Lots of times publishers have restrictions because they don't want to scare the audience. So therefore, it gets hidden in certain ways. All right. So the whole context, D, E. The communication of a narrative requires certain things. First of all, number one, it requires accuracy in literary analysis. If we fail at that level, then our failure infects everything else. So here again, I've tried to follow Fee and Stewart a little more than usual. Narrative does not mean in certain ways. And here's their two points, on page three. Narrative does not mean in an isolated verse or proof text manner. That's that cherry picking stuff. You don't run to the Bible to get a text. That's a pretext. That's taken out of context. Proof texting has been a big, big, big problem in American Christianity, and particularly in conservative churches. And a lot of it, I think, was fed by the King James Bible's format. Every verse in the King James Bible, which the generation that set the stereotypes for the church as we have it, by and large, every verse is in the left-hand column. So every verse looks like it's isolated. So you just verse, 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 verse. You don't see paragraphs. You don't see context. And you got to look real hard to find it. I really think that the format of that Bible, not intentionally, it's just the way it happened, did an awful lot to foster proof texting. Find a Bible verse. Find a Bible verse. People always want to find a Bible verse. Well, that's probably wrong-headed. Go to the Bible to find your answers, but not a proof text out of context. The second thing that we should not do is narrative items are not to be spiritualized. We had a teacher in Bible college, my first one, in Roanoke, Virginia. He came up from Columbia, South Carolina once a week and taught all day. He taught narrative classes is basically what he taught. Taught the particularly the Old Testament. Well, actually went through the whole Bible kind of in a narrative fashion. And his name was Mr. Sells. He was independently wealthy. His dad owned a lumber company in Knoxville, Tennessee, and his brother ran it, And Frank Sells got half, I guess, or pretty much. And he worked for a dollar a year at Columbia Bible College most of his career. And he was a generous man. He knew that we were church mice, poorest church mice. Everybody was. It seems we were struggling to pay what was considered pretty low tuition. But everybody liked to go up and talk to Mr. Sells because he'd do it very quietly and shyly. He'd slip you a $20 bill. And every now and then, when you, and you know, here, we could really spiritualize this one. You know, maybe you got a $50 bill that day and you really needed it. Well, you always really needed it, but the day you got it. And then one time I had an incident. I was so discouraged because we couldn't pay our hospitalization insurance. In fact, I got caught without hospitalization insurance and ended up in the hospital for a month when I was about 21. I'd gotten out of the Navy, hadn't gotten reorganized. We'd just got married. And, you know, we wanted to do the right thing. We just didn't have the means. And, man, I needed $50 like everything. And nothing happened all day long. I hung around up by the front. I smiled. I did all the right things, and nothing happened. Nothing. And I was walking back to my car, and Mr. Sells drove by and stuck a $50 bill out the window and gave it to me. Yeah, that was great. I tell you, it's good to have nothing because then you can see that God will take care of you when you're really destitute. Why would he take care of most of us in this room in terms of finances? You know, some need it more, but most of us are getting along. And I would be embarrassed to ask God for things that I used to need absolutely. Life changes as time goes on. But Mr. Sells always drove a new car. Well, he had to. He drove a lot. He went all over the country teaching. And he loved to talk about that phrase out of, I think it's out of Genesis, and it was about the famine. Don't go down to Egypt for help. And, of course, Egypt became a big type of the world. Don't do this. Do this, then I won't see whether you're committed to it. Okay. Egypt is a big type of the world. So one day we took a little piece of paper and put it on his front license plate, bought in Egypt. Now, one thing about Mr. Sells, he had a good heart and a good sense of humor as well. There used to be some ladies who would come to his classes. He was kind of a Ironside guy. Ironside was his hero. He's very, very flowery, great orator. But these ladies would come to class in Bible college, and we guys were sitting on the back row. These ladies would be up front just looking at Mr. Sells, and he'd say something that sounded so good. They'd grunt. And one day, we grunted. They grunt, we grunt. They get louder, we get louder. And he caught on to it after a while. You could just see he had a smirk on his face. Because there was not, he was a pious man, but he wasn't a pious piffle by any stretch of the imagination. 1 Samuel 17, I've heard a lot of people talk about, you got to slay the giant in your life. Get rid of who was that dude?
Steve Furtick?
No. The one David got with the rock. Goliath, yeah. You got to slay the Goliath in your life. Most of the books that I read early in my Christian journey, I wouldn't give you a nickel for today. Yet, because they were very spiritualizing, but I guess in a sense, they got across certain biblical values, but they abused the Bible to do it. And you know, it's not right, but God builds his work sometimes out of those kinds of things. Joseph is a type of Christ. I've heard people claim that over and over again. Joseph was not a type of Christ. The Bible never says so. And furthermore, as I mentioned at the beginning, Joseph was a brown nose with a dysfunctional family. Yet he came around, and you've read that in the book, about 2 minutes. What does narrative mean? It means holistically. A narrative, as you got to see the whole thing before you start making statements about the pieces. It's a play with acts and scenes. It's a symphony with movements. But it is a unified piece that you have to identify. And you say, well, how do I do that? Easy, same way I do. Get a good book. Get something that can help you. The church is going to start working on having a library. And that's just the way it is. There's no little blue phone on your desk you can dial up and God will tell you what it means. Contextually, parts are to be read in light of the whole. Intertextually, I'm going to show you a chart on Hannah and Mary. Mary was a woman of the Bible. And when her Magnificat that she spits out at Elizabeth's place is just loaded with Hannah's speech. The same themes of oppressed women in the Old Testament in a different way with Hannah, but with Mary and the uniqueness of what she was facing. Selectivity and arrangement. Biblical narrative is not bound by the Western expectation of chronological sequence, but it alters the material to tell the story. And the next couple of pages, I have some illustrations of that. Text and event. What do we have, class? What do we have left to us? The text. That's the only thing we've got. We have the text. Now, the people of that time who lived within the event had text and event, which at the end of the day has authority. Your reading of an event or the text. We talked too slightly about this before. Is the meaning of the Bible in the reader, or is the meaning of the Bible in the Bible? The Bible. It's in the Bible. And it's our responsibility to pull that out. And that's a disciplined responsibility. What has authority? We're bound by the text. When one shifts to the event, they begin to fill in details from their imagination rather than the Bible itself. Filling in details not in the text may sound biblical in content and may seem compelling, but it is the replacement of the Bible with their own imaginations and speculations. The writers are pretty focused. We don't need to make this stuff hard. By and large, narrative is probably more easy than we think it is, except for finding the clues. It's a search, it's a treasure hunt for clues. And we're going to see a number of pieces of that as we continue after page 3, or at the bottom of page 3 next time. Give me just 5 minutes, if you would. I'm a little over, but I want to just do F here. How to abuse a narrative. I remember driving to school one morning, I forget which class I was going to be teaching, and I heard a famous preacher on the radio talk about Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8. The account of Philip, he said, is a lesson on commendable traits of a soul winner. Now, you know, I mean, Philip is out there trying to win the Ethiopian eunuch, so you call him a soul winner. The Bible never uses that nomenclature, but go ahead, have at it. A commendable traits of soul winner. He tied the following key words to verses. He put these words on the text. Sensitivity. If it's a good soul winner, it's got to have sensitivity. Well, you do, don't you? Availability. Initiative. Tactfulness. Well, it makes a good sermon. I'm sure somebody preached it the next Sunday when they heard that on the radio. But my friends, that's an abuse of Scripture. No matter how pious it might seem. Now you can, I don't care if you teach all day long about those four traits of being a good witness, but just don't make the Bible teach it from that text. While this sounds like good preaching, actually it abuses the Bible. The text has absolutely nothing to do with that. Why is this account in Acts? Why is Philip there? It's one part of a larger narrative of the spread of the gospel that Acts 8:1 indicates to the disciples. Page 4. That they were going to go from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria and to the ends of the earth. Then we watch the text of Acts lay this out in 8:4, 12, 25, 35, and 40. The activities in Jerusalem in 1 to 8. The church is scattered in 8:2 and 3. Philip proclaims Christ in Samaria in 8:4. Philip proclaims Christ to the ends of the earth, which was the African eunuch, 8:26-40. Then Paul's conversion and missionary activity finishes out the book of Acts from chapter 9-28 to the ends of the earth. So that's what Philip was in the narrative for, to show how God was making that happen as he had promised. Acts 8 is sort of a microcosm of the rest of that book. It continues to portray the development of Acts 1:8. The Philip story is part of the factual expansion of Christianity beyond Jerusalem. Luke Acts is the biggest narrative in the New Testament. It's written by one author who wasn't an apostle, but was under the tutelage of the Apostle Paul. He wrote more than Paul did, Luke Acts did. But everybody just loves to go over there and read those little epistles all the time. Which is fine, yeah. Okay, that's where we're going to stop, page 4, number 3. And we'll pick up here next time. And I'm going to push. Please look at those illustrations. The charts are interesting. They should be reasonably self-explanatory. I think you'll be impressed with some of them. Like the flood narrative. What a beautiful, beautiful thing. The Bible writers were not just authors, they were craftsmen of the highest caliber in the ancient world. Let's pray.